We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is the podcast of the Election Integrity Network, which is sponsored by the Conservative Partnership Institute in Washington, D.C. This podcast is about all things elections, all things related to elections, how elections are supposed to work, how sometimes they don't work the way they're supposed to, and what we as citizens can do to try to make sure that our election process is conducted in accordance with the law and is fair and open and honest. And we're very honored today to have as our guest Scott Rasmussen, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, you've seen on TV. He, I'm going to let him tell you about himself because he has a really interesting background, some of which I'm not sure most people know. So Scott, welcome so much to our podcast, Who's Counting? Thank you for being with me today.
Well, Cleta, it's always great to be with you. And because I respect you, I'm not going to tell people how long ago it was that you and I met.
It's a long time ago.
long time ago. But, you know, one of the things that you and I have joked about over the years is the world of sports.
Yes, that's right.
I'm a Yankee fan, and you may not have such great memories of a perfect game from a long time
that's
ago.
That's true. My family lineage and my father-in-law, my late father-in-law is a great baseball trivia question because he was the batter who was the last out in Don Larsen's perfect game in the 1956 World Series. So that did not go down very well. No, it was a called strike, and he said it was high and outside. And he was also, he was a player who was a very good hitter, had a lifetime 312 batting average. He played in the big leagues between 1946 and 1956. And he was known for never striking out. So, I mean, his record was, I think he only struck out 119 times in 10 years. So he didn't strike out. And so he was pretty angry about that call literally to the day he died.
Well, and, you know, just to bring that to a close, I've been a Yankees fan forever. And I was at an event just a couple of years ago where they brought Don Larsen out for the last time. And David Cone and David Wells were the only pitchers who also threw perfect games for the Yankees.
That's right.
Just treated him with such respect. I mean, it was just a really nice moment. So anyhow, but that's sports is in my background. And then a million years ago, back in the days of the 70s, when there was only one college football game on each week, my father and I learned of this new technology called satellite broadcasting. We learned you could send a signal around America far more efficiently than you could with the old landline transmissions. And that led to an idea that a few of your listeners may have heard of, your viewers, ESPN came out of that whole discussion. We pitched it to Getty Oil. And the reason we went to Getty is because every broadcast company in the world told us we were nuts. It would never work.
They told you satellite TV was a crazy idea that was never going to happen.
Satellite TV was never going to happen. Who's going to watch sports all day? This is crazy. It's not going to work. But it's had a pretty good run. Actually, one of the really fun things they did on their 40th anniversary, ESPN came down and they showed us videos of the very first night's broadcast and asked us what we remembered about that night. And they also went, our very first game was a slow pitch softball championship because everything else got rained out. And they brought the players in that game and had them interviewed as well. And it was kind of a hoot looking back.
That's great. Well, you were in Bristol, Connecticut. Isn't that where you were born and raised?
Well, no. I was born on Eglin Air Force Base and moved around a lot. But we were in New England at that point. And Bristol, you know, and it's really hard to imagine. People didn't think there were a lot of places you could transmit to the satellite back in the 70s. And we knew that a cable system had a a satellite, a place cleared for satellite uplinks. So that's why it became Bristol, and a lot of other silliness to the whole story. You know, we launched it with a cash advance on my credit card, didn't really know what we were doing, but it was the right idea at the right time. And Getty was beginning to look for other things. It was in the midst of the second era of oil embargo. They had something, you know, I'm sure you deal with a problem like this all the time. They had their vice president of what became Diversified Operations received an excess cash report every single Friday. You know, they had to find a way to invest this and say, you know, I'm sure that's part of your weekly routine.
No, I have to
figure
out my extra cash laying around. Right. Well, one of the things I remember is that you wanted to be able to cover all the high school sports in your area. If I remember correctly, the story you told about that, and that you actually were calling local high school hockey matches. And that sort of thing.
Yeah, I began doing high school hockey radio broadcast with my father. I did my first radio commercial when I was 6 years old, back in 7 years old, back in 1963. So it goes back quite a ways. Did some hockey, did a lot of that, and then was announcing for the Whalers hockey team. They're now the Carolina Hurricanes, and the Whalers couldn't get on TV. And that's what led the adventure to get into the world of learning about satellites and cable, because we just, you know, and again, only people who have been friends as long as you and I have remember the era when there were only three television networks.
That's
but
right.
You just couldn't see sports on television. And we talked to Connecticut cable operators about this idea of, you know, we could show maybe Bristol Red Sox baseball in the summer and some UConn basketball and some Whalers hockey and mix in a bunch of things. And they laughed us out of the room, but did tell us about the satellite. And the man who told us about the satellite, Al Perinello, still keep in touch with him. He was a little bit of an entrepreneur too, but what he told us, and this was really remarkable. You know, in those days, you would send a broadcast signal around the state via landlines. AT&T had a monopoly on the business. And the satellite let us reach the whole nation for less money than it used to cost to reach Connecticut.
Wow.
And as soon as we heard that, we were like, there's something here. This is big. And ultimately, that was the asset that let us go. We secured a position on the satellite before we had the idea that became ESPN. And then when we came up with the idea, we were so clueless about how to go about this. We were afraid if we told people they would steal the idea from us. Instead, we had to sell and sell and sell. And when Getty said yes, we were wondering what took them so long, you know, and it was really only a very few months.
Well, so one of my other favorite stories, and then we will talk about elections, but I love this story because it's such an American story. It's such a great story of American ingenuity and all, but didn't you come up with the idea for having an evening, sort of the evening news being called Sports Center, and having a broadcast that was just about kind of a wrap up of the news of sports of the day?
You know, and again, you have to look back at the time that we were in. What you had in those days was three networks, and the local TV stations had a 30-minute local news, and then you had the national news. And the local sportscasters got about 2 or 3 minutes in their newscast.
Right. It usually went sort of 10 to 15 minutes news, maybe
right.
5 to 10 minutes weather, and then maybe five to seven minutes sports. That's the way I grew up.
Right. And almost all of it was about your local team. And in fact, one of the challenges we faced in those days was a lot of people told us, well, nobody cares about sports anywhere else. And I was thinking, no, you know, if you're a Dallas Cowboys fan, you care about what happens to the Redskins and the Eagles and the Giants because they're your competitors. But that was a novel idea back then. But in the midst of it, yes, we're thinking, okay, we're going to show sports back to back. What do we do in between? And the initial idea was that between every event, we would have a brief something called the Sports Center, and then we would have an evening news that was the Sports Center. Very few people know this, but earlier, a few years, 3 or 4 years before that, we had done a show called Sports Only on a local Hartford television station that was basically a Connecticut version of it. And so Sports Center, they give me credit for coming up with the idea for the name and for some of that. I think looking back on it, there were so many ideas swirling around. But Cleta, I got to tell you one last thing that was just really a fun thing. There were about six people who I can honestly say without them, ESPN never would have happened. And three of them have passed away. And other than my father, there's only one left. And he heard me speak at an event in Wisconsin last year. And he was a guy who always hated the spotlight. But I introduced him and told everybody all that he had done to make ESPN happen. He was the financial reviewer for Getty Oil. He did the due diligence work. And he was a little embarrassed at first. But after that, when I finished my talk, he just held court and was telling all these stories about all the old days. And he even did tell the story of me coming up with the name for the Sports Center. So it was kind of a fun time.
That's great. Well, it is, like I say, it's a great American story. And you went from being involved in ESPN. Eventually, I guess you sold your company, your interest in that. And I want you to tell people a little bit about, first thing, how is the way to pronounce your last name? I've heard it Rasmussen. How do you introduce yourself?
It's Rasmussen.
Rasmussen.
But I answer to any of them. And by the way, people have also called me a lot worse, so it's okay.
All right. So Rasmussen, Scott Rasmussen. Yeah. So tell everybody how people know you and your work in polling, but that isn't what you've done always. I mean, you've had a very interesting and varied career. So talk to us about after ESPN, tell us about, because you were you in high school at the time that you and are in college?
I dropped out of college during I'd gone for a year and a half of college, dropped out to be an announcer for a hockey team. Then we did ESPN, sold in 1984, Getty Oil was bought by Texaco. And Texaco spun off all the non-oil assets. The style of the 80s. So that's when we sold out way back then. And I wasn't sure what to do next. So I did go back and finish my college degree, got to meet my wife. So that was a good bonus from the whole process. But also during that time, I really felt an obligation to do something, give something back, and began looking into budget issues because I'm a numbers geek. Wrote a book on the federal budget.
Oh, wow.
Connie Mack, who was then wasn't even in the Senate then. He was still in the House. He wrote the foreword to the book. And that got me stumbling around and learning about politics. I was very naive and idealistic at the time. Ran into some people, including you, who were promoting term limits.
Right.
Got very involved in the term limits movement. And somewhere along the way, I was doing volunteer work to help the term limits movement get better polling. I had studied polling under Everett Ladd in college.
Wow.
And so I knew probably not as much as I thought I did about it, but I knew a little bit and was asked to put out a shingle. And a friend of ours, Howie Rich, said, you know, why don't you do some polling for us? And I started doing it and really didn't have any idea of the way the industry was going to change. You know, back then our big technology complaint was answering machines. Not everybody will pick up the phone anymore.
The phone calls were all landlines. So about when did you start doing polling? About 1995?
My very first poll was actually in 88.
Oh, wow.
But when I began to do it on a regular sustained basis was in the 94 cycle. And then it took off from there. And what was fortuitous for me at that time was there was also this new technology called the internet coming out.
Oh, wow.
I put up a website, didn't really know what to do with it. In fact, I think I'd be really embarrassed if I could remember all my original thoughts of how the internet would work. But what quickly happened, and I didn't fully appreciate it as I was going through it, I began to realize that the internet was media. It was just like a satellite distribution system, except, you know, on steroids, I guess. You could reach everybody now. And I began putting out polling data online as a promotional tool. And I began to be startled with all the people that would start quoting my polls. And then Fox News came along. And, you know, this is probably not quite, not precisely accurate, but I was probably the only pollster with a real broadcast background. I mean, I'd spent my life growing up in broadcasting, and now I was doing polling. And so I could go on TV and talk about numbers in a different way. And that just began to take off and build this polling mindset. And one of the things that I always did is I tried to look at questions from a different perspective. You know, there's an inside the beltway view of the world. And then there's the way the rest of America sees the world. And on any question at all, there's at least two or three different ways you can ask it. And so I began doing that, got into developing what became known as automated polling, where we would have.
And how does that, how does that work?
So instead of a live operator calling, you know, you get a call from that. Nowadays, you'd complain about it. But back in the 90s, people still answered the phone and would talk to a recorded voice. And we made a lot of efforts to really make it quick and user-friendly. And what it did was it let me poll more than anybody else. I was doing, you know, 1,000 interviews a night, every night.
Wow.
And so I could, when Bill Clinton had his problems with Monica Lewinsky, I remember my first night of polling, and I was talking to the Charlotte Observer because I was living in Charlotte then. We're going over the results and we were surprised. Well, it was a shock to see how people responded. But what I was able to do and nobody else was I had another 1,000 interviews going out the next night so I could go and begin to explore a little further. And from there, it just really exploded. It was, I think anybody under 40 or 50 has no idea how little polling was done prior to really to my starting this daily polling routine. When Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House for a very long time, the databases show only about 3 times where national polls conducted on his job approval rating. You know, Nancy Wow. Pelosi probably has 3 polls a week these days. And it really changed things to have that daily update. And it was really nice in those days because Gallup was out there and there were some campaign polls, but not a lot of additional things. So I could consciously say, I want to do something a little different than ask it differently than Gallup or CBS, New York Times would have some polls. And I would never say I was right and they were wrong. What I would say is they asked it from this perspective. I asked it from this perspective. You learn something when you compare the results. And along the way, just a number of things happened. Larry Kudlow worked with me to create a daily consumer confidence index that really caught fire. There were some moments when the bailouts happened, in the midst of the financial crisis, Gallup came out with a poll immediately saying 75% of people supported the bailouts. And I came out with a poll showing it was about 30%. And when you looked at it, what Gallup did was they included the people who supported it and those who would support it with major changes.
That's a big difference. That's a big difference.
So this whole idea, again, of going out, you have to ask. There is no right way to ask a question because we use different languages. You have to ask from a variety of perspectives. And that became somewhat of my trademark. And I now call the process counter polling. So I go out and whether it's election integrity or any other issue, I look at what others are polling and I ask from a different perspective to try and lift up the voices of people that aren't being heard.
So you started this polling company and then what was the name of that company?
Rasmussen Reports. I was all with right. them until 2000, early 2013.
So you sold that company.
Right. Left
with
there.
Your name. With your name.
Yes.
You sold Rasmussen Reports with the name. Now, why did you do that? Were you planning to continue polling?
Probably not. You know, yeah.
I think you left to do some other things, I thought.
I did. I wrote a book, right. Politics Has Failed, America Will Not. I'm still very optimistic about where our country is going, despite being pessimistic about our political system. I looked into some other ways to deliver news in a less politicized manner. You know, and to be blunt, it was really nice during an election season to see my wife every now and then. It was just it was a nice break. But you know,
it's in your blood.
So I came back when my non-compete ran out, came back and started polling again. And the world has changed a lot. And again, just to give you a sense, I did some polling in the early days of Rasmussen Reports for some London parliamentary elections.
Oh, wow.
And I was prepared to answer all their questions about why are automated phone calls okay instead of live operator calls. And in London, they were still wondering if phone polls were okay or if you had to do in-home interviews. The gap was enormous. And now we've come full circle. The least accurate polling methods today are the ones that use live operators because nobody talks on the phone. And even if you call somebody on a cell phone, that's not normal. I mean, truthfully, if I called one of my sons and said, hey, you know, just called them out of the blue, didn't text or do something first, I think their first reaction would be, is mom okay? I mean, you know, because people don't do that. So phones aren't as reliable. People aren't answering them. They're screening them. And so now we use all kinds of new ways to try and reach people. The specific challenges are different, but the basic idea is the same. You still have to make sure to get a representative sample of all segments of America. And then you need to weight them in the right manner, balance them in the right manner. And some of the people that are very hard to get a hold of in today's world, people that live in rural zip codes, you know, the smallest population areas you can measure are about 250 people per square mile or less. They have views that are much different than people who live in Manhattan or Washington or bluntly even in most suburbs. And if you're not really careful, they will slip through the cracks. So you design a survey method to reach all segments of the population. And then I think it's also really important for pollsters to admit, have a little bit of humility about the work. An example I've loved giving in the last couple of years is Burgess Owens was running for Utah 4 Congressional District.
Great American. And, yeah, he's a wonderful person.
Wonderful man. And my last poll shocked me, and I was a little bit nervous about reporting the results to the newspaper that had hired me to do it. I showed Burgess up by a point, and Burgess was gracious enough to win the election by 1 point to make my poll look really good. You know, and that's ultimately what it's all about. And I would love to tell you that that's because my polling was perfect and brilliant. But the reality is my poll had a 3.5 point margin of error. It is not the right tool to tell you who's going to win a 1 point race. What it did tell you very effectively was it's going to be very close. And I gave different turnout models and said, well, you know, it could go either way depending on where turnout ends. And I think we need to do that with a lot of polls. People underestimate the impact of just a couple of percentage points. As you well know, a couple of percentage points in a few states in 2020 presidential election, we'd have a different president in the White House right now.
That's right.
If you talk about a 2-point turnout swing in congressional races, it might mean the difference between a party winning 20 seats and 40 seats. So polls can give you a good idea of where to watch. They can give you a good idea of how close races are and which ones aren't so close. And we all make a mistake, and a lot of analysts make a big mistake trying to be too precise with it. And Cleta, before we jump into other topics, one thing I want to bring up about polling, you know, if you talk about the presidential race, wow, the polls were off. first of all, they weren't really as far off as people tend to believe. Secondly, if you get rid of the operator-assisted polls, the old school polls, the averages looked a little better. But even they still were off by several points. But if I talk to you about a 2 or 3 point difference in a close election, that makes a big difference between projecting Joe Biden or Donald Trump to win or a particular Senate race. But if I talk to you about an issue like photo ID, and I say that 80% of the people support it, well, maybe I'm 3 points off. Maybe it's 83, maybe it's 77, but that still gives you the sense of where the country is. And that's the way you have to look at it.
Well, and that's really what I want to talk to you about today, because we have this divide in our country. And I think it's a divide between the elitists who sort of run the country or think they do versus everybody else. Certainly when it comes to the topic that is the topic of our podcast and the Election Integrity Network. And that is these principles of what constitutes ensuring that our elections are conducted honestly and where only legal votes are counted and illegal votes are not allowed into the system. I think people talk about voter fraud. I don't really talk about fraud so much as it is manipulating the system and getting ballots into the coffers that shouldn't be there in the first place. But so that's really sort of the efforts that we're undertaking and how citizens can help, because the election system does anticipate, and in every state law, there's a role for citizens to become election workers and poll observers. And we haven't done our part as citizens, I don't think, over the last decade to really be part of the election system as we have to be if it's going to be conducted in accordance with the law. But that brings me to these components. I mean, you have been doing polling and questioning about these different issues with regard to election integrity. And that's really what I'd like to ask you to talk about. And you mentioned photo ID. Talk to us a little bit about how you approach asking the questions, because as you say, how you ask the questions and talking to people to get their views, not from the perspective of the insiders in Washington, D.C. or the elitists at the New York Times or Hollywood, but how do you approach the issue of fair and honest elections? How do you construct your questions?
Well, again, the first thing you have to do is not talk like you're at a Georgetown cocktail party, right? Because that view of the world doesn't connect anywhere else in America. I start by looking at some baseline attitudes, and that's a little scary. The baseline attitudes right now are that people don't trust the election process at any level. And the evidence or example number one of that is I've been asking for years about who was the legitimate winner of different elections. I've asked it in different ways. If I went back to the 90s when Bill Clinton was in office, about half of all voters thought elections were fair. Mostly Democrats, because Bill Clinton was in the White House.
Right.
When George W. Bush got elected, half of America still thought elections were fair. It was just the other half. Now, the intensity wasn't the same back then, but people in close elections tend to believe that things are fair when their team comes out on top.
Okay.
And Cleta, one of the underlying problems we have with distrust in elections is we have not had a landslide since 1984. We've had 9 straight elections with nobody winning more than 53% of the vote. So every election, there's this sense of if we just done it a little differently, if the votes broke differently in this state. You know, when Walter Mondale lost 49 states, nobody said he could have won by going to Wisconsin. Nobody talked about that. So those landslides were a regular feature of American politics from about 1920 until 1972. Every year, every election or every other election, we had a landslide, kind of cleanse the process. We don't have that anymore. We have this sense that in close elections, everybody's a little bit suspicious of the other side. So today, as we sit here, a majority of Democrats continue to believe that Hillary Clinton was the legitimate winner in 2016.
Do they say why? Do they say why they think that? Is it Russia? Was the whole Russia hoax or what?
Sometimes they'll say Russia. Sometimes it's just a general. I think you can never really tell why anybody's individual response is the way it is. But I think it's because everybody was so rock solid certain she was going to win. It never occurred to people that she could lose. Never occurred to her supporters she could lose.
I see. So
I think they were shocked and began to look for excuses. So yes, it was Russia. It was something else. Yeah. Some might say, well, she won the popular vote, so the system is wrong. I mean, you know, there were different reasons. The numbers and the attitudes we see among Democrats on that are mirrored by the numbers we see on Republicans who think Donald Trump won in 2020. So both sides have this distrust. And what worries me is that only one out of four voters believes that the right person was named president after our last two elections. If you want to talk about a crisis of our constitutional system, it is the fact that only one out of four people are confident that presidential elections are properly determined. I mean, that's really scary to me.
I agree with you 100%. That's the part that worries me the most. Because then what I think the next step in that is people say, why bother to vote?
Right.
And that is what I worry about as much as anything. And what do you say?
I was just going to say one other part of it. What's also led to nearly 60% of voters believe that both political parties would cheat to steal an election if they could get away with it.
Oh, wow. That's lovely.
This is not Republican or Democrat. This is how deep the cynicism is. And when we ask people, how confident are you that, you know, the votes will be properly counted? Again, you get 60% saying, you know, they're kind of confident. So to me, when you ask, how do I begin to ask about this? Well, I begin with a recognition that we have a crisis, and that the crisis is that we need to restore trust in our electoral system. That's the issue. So then I begin to talk about lots of issues that are out there in the political dialogue, and ask about them in a variety of ways. You know, if I were to ask about what the Democrats were calling the For the People Act, and I asked about it in aspirational tones, the way a Democrat would have described it, well, 70% of voters say they like the idea. However, when I did a follow-up question, it turns out that a majority of the people who said they liked it thought that it would require photo ID for all ballots to be cast. Mm. Because to voters, that was part of what reform would look like. Now, I've asked about photo ID probably in 20 different ways. And no matter how you ask about it, it's one of those issues that people understand. It's common sense. And somewhere between 70 and 85% of voters always say they're in favor of it. It's a majority of every demographic group, racial and ethnic groups, partisan groups, young and old. And I think the reason it's so solid is because we show ID for everything. I mean, this is not a crazy theory. So that's one. There are three issues that I think are really absolutely strong support among voters who don't get into the weeds of all the stuff that, you know, that frightens some of us who look into it a little deeper. Photo ID is one. And by the way, that includes photo ID when you submit a mail-in ballot. So that's...
People want to see a photo ID with the mail-in ballot.
With the mail-in ballot.
I think that's exactly right. I think the people are right. They're way ahead of the politicians on that.
Well, that's always the case. You know, Cleta, people today think that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence to inspire us to fight a war. What they don't realize is that Jefferson wrote that 15 months after the fighting began. 11 of the British governors had already been forced to flee the country. It was important that he wrote that, but that was after the people had already made something happen. So that's true.
That's true. That's the historic view. That's true. Historical fact.
So the next big reform that people like is cleaning the voter rolls election.
Yeah.
And again, I think you have to look at this. We're not in the horse and buggy era anymore. If I left New York a couple of years ago, moved to Florida. When I registered to vote here, there should be an easy and automatic way that when I register here, somebody in New York gets pinged in a database and says he can't be registered to vote there anymore. I mean, that's not right. Hard to do. It takes a little more effort when people pass away, or if somebody doesn't register to vote in a new home. But the idea of cleaning voter rolls shouldn't be that difficult to process. Again, that's something that more than 80% of voters support.
I have to tell you that one of the things I've been worried about the voter rolls for a while. Right. But I will tell you that after the experience of 2020 and 2021 dealing with citizens all over the country who started going to their election offices, looking at voter rolls and all, and I mean, I just think they're in so much worse shape than I even realized. And I will say this, the left has made it very difficult to remove people from the rolls. I mean, when I was growing up in Oklahoma, there was the statute said, if you did not vote in a general election, a presidential election, that's when everybody votes, right? In two presidential elections, then you were removed from the rolls. Well, you can't do that anymore. And there've been all these court cases. And so our voter rolls are just so polluted. I'll just give you one more fact that we included in the election contest that we filed on behalf of President Trump post-election in Georgia in 2020. The margin between President Trump and Joe Biden was 11,779 votes. Now, let me just say this, that was the third number. And one would think it would be a dead giveaway that there would be a problem if you recount, if you have the count and two recounts and you get three different numbers, that ought to tell you that there's something wrong. You can't reconcile the numbers. But in one category of problematic votes, we found 18,325 people who voted from a registration address that was a vacant lot, according to the government records. Well, there's something wrong with that. But we found 39 categories of votes that were cast and counted in violation of state law. So I just realized, you know, the bottom line is the voter rolls. And I'm really glad to hear, because I don't really think that I had focused on the numbers of people, Americans who support the idea of cleaning the voter rolls before every election. That's pretty amazing.
And again, if that's a little bit like, you know, if you're going to take care of your car, you change the oil every now and then. This is
right. It's just basic.
So basic. In fact, I haven't polled on it, but maybe I should, to see how many people are shocked that it's not done all the time.
Oh, right.
Because again, that's just, if you have a governing system, regardless of which side you want to win, regardless of which side's in power, you would expect that that's a basic process.
Right.
So the third item that has tremendous support, again, over 80% in just about every way I've asked it, is that all ballots should be received by election day.
Right.
and part of that is, okay, going back to the sports world, you know, when the game ends, the game ends. You don't get to add three touchdowns in 2 weeks later. So there's this sense that on election day, all the ballots should be in, and we would expect to hear that night, or maybe in the wee hours of the next morning, who won each state. And to me, this is a really important provision. And the reason I say that is, regardless of what you thought was going on, say in Pennsylvania, in 2020, if on election night, all the ballots had been in and the totals came out and Joe Biden was declared the winner, that would have generated a lot more confidence in the results than what happened, dragging it out for week after week and hearing these stories of new ballots and everything else. So purely in terms of restoring confidence in the system, and also because, a vote, that's why do you call it election day? Because that's the day when you finish, and that's when you know who won. So one of the things that one of the reasons I emphasize that a lot is many people who are upset about what happened in 2020 want to either eliminate mail-in voting or put other restrictions on. And I got to tell you, first of all, there's no public support for getting rid of mail-in balloting. I mean, that's now, is there support for restrictions? Absolutely. But you can get hung up about should the ballots be available 2 weeks early or 3 weeks early, or you can get hung up on lots of those details. But if the goal is initially whatever else happens, you have to get them in by election day, I think you solve a lot of the problems that are out there, and then you move us forward. So that's a significant step. And if I was thinking of how to campaign on these issues for the 2022 election and 2024, I would tell every candidate, these are the three things I'm for. Photo ID, clean the voter rolls and all ballots in by election day. And then we'll begin to clean up the process.
Let me ask you about some other things. These are all issues, the things that you've talked about are issues where there's 80%.
Right.
A real consensus among everybody, but maybe a few partisan activists, elites on one side.
Right.
What about some of the other, maybe, have you ever polled on things like, one of the things that worries me is that there used to be election day and everybody went to it was a sort of a national collective right that we exercised.
Right.
On the same day. And we obviously didn't all vote the same way, but we did it at the same time with the same information. And now what we have is election season. I mean, we now have voting started in Virginia in 2021 on September 17th, 45 days of early voting. And I wonder, I wonder if you've done any polling on that extended period of time. People care about that? Do they wish it were more of election day? Or is that just not something that's on anyone's radar?
So I've done a lot of polling on that. And I'll start with something where there's also consensus. People do like the idea of making election day a holiday.
Right.
So that's
although I don't know why you make election day a holiday if everybody's voted by the time you get
right.
there.
Well, and so that's the next part of it. People don't, and again, I think it's really important to recognize when you poll, people aren't sitting around thinking about the precise issues involved before you reach out to them. But people do not like a very extended campaign season. If I press the polling, people, I think a majority would say you should be able to vote early, maybe 2 weeks early. But if I said 3 weeks, that's not that big a deal either. It's when you start to go beyond measuring things in 2-3 week increments. When you start talking about a month early, 45 days early, people are uncomfortable with that. But Kalita, they are more uncomfortable with the ballots that come in afterwards than they are about the early process.
Well, that's it. Also, too, one of the things I think is if there's are these protracted periods of time for when people can vote, why do you need to extend it past election day?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense to me. There is another thing this is probably way too nuanced to poll about, but I'm going to throw it out there in case you have or in case you have the opportunity. And that is this thing called curing ballots, because one of the things that's happened in a number of states is that not only it's not just that you get the ballots in by election day, but then you have 3 or 4 days following the election where you have partisans seeing, you have these ballots that omit the required signature or this or that, when you have the parties going out and chasing voters to say, hey, your ballot's not going to get counted unless you go down and fix it. I mean, to me, that is just insanity. because you've got other people interjecting themselves in the process. It ought to be between the voter and the election office, and you shouldn't have partisans being able to chase people down for 3 or 4 days after the election, but that's happening.
Right. So this gets back to the same concept of if the votes have to be in by election day, that's a deadline. This is a nuance that not many people think about in the election process, but I think it's fair to say, based on the, because I have asked about it and you get a sense of it. If somebody submits a ballot early and there is something wrong with it and they can fix it before election day, you know, if they got a notice from the election office, hey, we received a ballot in your name, but there was no signature. Was that you? You know, I think most people would be okay with that before election day. And again, it's hard to pull because it's such a hard question
to explain.
Right. But based on everything else I see, that seems to be it. And by the way, to your point about activists, there's very strong opposition to ballot harvesting.
Really?
Yes. Now, there's an idea that, you know, maybe a family member could take your ballot down or something. But the idea of what has been transpiring is just not, it doesn't strike people as fair. They just see too many opportunities for cheating. And Cleta, one thing about this, you said earlier, the elites versus everybody else. To the elites, it's all about winning. To everybody else, they want a fair process.
Yes, that's true. That's exactly right. Lynn Taylor, who is the president of the Virginia Institute for Public Policy, which is a conservative policy organization, and they also chair the Virginia Institute more or less supports, and she chairs the Virginia Fair Elections Coalition. And she always says, and it sometimes makes some Republicans mad when she says this, she says, look, Virginia was a red state for many, many decades. It became a blue state over a few cycles. It became a red state again. She said, I don't care if it's red or blue, if Virginia is red or blue. I just want to make sure that it is Virginians making the decision in accordance with the law, and whether it's red or blue, that everybody knows that it was a fair process. And I just think that that encapsulates everything that we believe. Obviously, we want our people to win. I do, you do, but I'm just so worried about the manipulation of the process that that causes this. I think it's so destructive to our republic.
I mean, look, that is my big concern. If we don't have faith in elections, I believe our nation was founded on the ideals of freedom, equality, and self-governance. Now, self-governance means a lot of things. It means you have individual liberty. But it also means that you have to have a fair voice in electing who your representatives are, who your governing officials are. And if you don't believe you have that, as you said earlier, you're not as likely to participate, and you're not as likely to respect the elected leaders. So it's a very serious issue. There's horrible events happening in Ukraine these days. We've been through a terrible pandemic. There's other challenges to our nation and to the globe. But if we can't get elections right, we don't have the legitimacy our government, regardless of who's in power, does not have the legitimacy to address the issues.
Well, you mentioned the pandemic, and I love it when people say, oh, the rules were changed because of the pandemic. And yes, that is true, but I always tell people, these left-wing organizations began filing lawsuits challenging election laws. They'd already filed almost 100 suits in the early part of 2019. This was a year before COVID, but they found a convenient pretext when COVID came along. Oh, this is the reason we have to change these laws in the courts, not just secretaries of state, like in Pennsylvania and Michigan, just saying, oh, you know, that law that requires signature matching. Well, just ignore that. You don't have to do that. But, and one thing that I think is really interesting is all these changes that were presumably made because of keeping people safe because of COVID. How is letting a perfect stranger go door to door to collect ballots and put them in boxes. How is that safe and consistent with the idea of protecting people against COVID?
This goes right back to the idea that people think both sides will cheat. If there's an advantage, they're going to figure out a way to use it. If COVID helps your side, activists will use it. And that is a big part of the problem that we face. When we talk about this, though, it's not about were mistakes made? Yes. During the pandemic, absolutely. Were some of them clearly just taking advantage of the opportunity? Absolutely. Were some of them just because things happen? Absolutely. But that's in the past. What we need to be talking about is how do you fix this process going forward? And I think one of the really good things is that not only are a lot of states taking action to put some reasonable safeguards in place, but the national storyline is that, I'd say it precisely, but the national storyline is along the lines of Republicans are trying to suppress the vote to cheat because it's the only way they can win. And democracy is at stake, is at risk because of what these Republican legislatures are doing. One of the reasons that's not catching fire is that the people who are more concerned about the problems with democracy tend to be Republicans. Democratic voters are not as upset about it. And that's partly because their team's in power right now. But the energy to talk about restoring trust in our election process comes from conservatives and Republicans. And so therefore, when somebody is saying we need to pass this Democratic bill to restore confidence in elections, it doesn't make sense to the people who are paying attention to the issue.
Are there other election related issues that come to mind that you think are that we should be aware of what people think about? Any other particular ones besides the ones you've mentioned?
There's always questions about money in the election process, and there's no real good solution to it. And again, there's just deep skepticism. Why do people give to a candidate? Well, voters tend to think that small business owners give because they're afraid the politicians will hurt them if they don't give. It's kind of an extortion racket. So there's a lot of cynicism about that. The issue, we've heard a lot of talk about the money that Zuckerberg put into selected campaign areas. And to be honest,
most people don't really know about that. They
don't know about it. And when you explain it as somebody giving private money to help understaffed election offices, wow, people love it. When you explain it as they gave it to only certain election offices that would, have a certain profile of voter, well, then people think, no, if you want to give money, it should go be spread around to the entire state or the entire region. So again,
equally, on an equal basis.
Right. But now the minute we start talking about this, we're talking about an issue that when I reach out to them, they haven't heard about, they don't really have any thought. What they have is a gut sense that that's unfair. To select your areas. So, and in terms of other election issues, the questions about poll watchers or particular restrictions, again, people just aren't thinking of it, aren't aware of it. They do believe it sounds good to have people from both parties be able to watch every single step of the election process, every single step of the chain of custody for ballots. There's strong support for having all voting machines made in the US, but that's partly a made in America reality. It's also partly distrust of China these days. So there's,
it's interesting because a lot of people talk about the law says, the voting machines are not allowed to be connected to the internet. And then I watched a video the other day and this person said, so why are there modems in the voting machines if they're not supposed to be connected to the internet? Right. And I thought, good point.
But again, we can talk about all these details. right now, there is a crisis. There is a crisis that people don't trust election results. There are three big reforms that people feel very strongly about. There's a national consensus on. And if you made those three things, photo ID, clean the voter rolls, and all ballots in by election day, you won't solve all the problems, but you'll make a big step forward. You know, and that's, I think that's, a, it's important to keep that focus.
Well, maybe we can help. I mean, I think that what you've described is really important. And if you have any reports that you've done that you'd like to have us post on our website about these issues, we would love to do that. Because I think that's actually something that citizens ought to be asking their every candidate right. for everything from every party. Will you support? I would call that a voting rights pledge that protects everybody's right to vote. And that we should make that a national movement to have citizens asking candidates for office, will you support these three things? That's I like that as an idea to galvanize and mobilize people.
And that's, you know, just to be clear, I wrote an article for National Review talking about these issues, and it is on the CPI website. So it's already up there somewhere, but
we'll get
yes.
it.
Yes. Those are things that, those are issues, and I think the voter pledge, you know, we have a lot of experience working with those in the past, and I think those are three good issues for that.
Well, Scott, tell us, what is your new venture? If people want to find you now, where do they find you? What is your website today?
The website is scottrasmussen.com.
Okay.
And what I'm doing these days is, I mentioned earlier, it's counter polling. I'm consciously polling on questions from a different perspective. And then I'm talking to people about how to translate that into messaging. And one of the, I guess, more unique for me aspects of this is for the first time in my life, I'm not really doing a lot of media or polls. I'm doing a fake occasional podcast with an old friend. But for the most part, you know, I'm working with others and helping them understand how to communicate.
Well, that is wonderful because you are a true American patriot. I'm also going to put the link up to your book. And the name of it is When Politics Fail.
Politics Has Failed, America Will Not.
And Politics Has Failed, America Will Not. I love that message. And you've given us a lot to think about and some to-dos to put on our task list to make sure that America doesn't fail. So, Scott, thank you for being with me and with our audience. You really are, it's such an interesting story. I love hearing about this because, like I say, it's, you know, American ingenuity and only in America. So thank you so much for being with us. And this concludes our podcast, this episode of Who's Counting? And we will be back next week with another podcast. If you want to help make sure that your elections are secure, get involved, get engaged, work on that pledge that Scott outlined, and come go to the EIN website, www.whoscounting.us, and share this podcast, get engaged, get involved. Let's help save our country.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.